already listened to the prior week's episode when the live event was announced. We gathered around the table, and Ray Stallings, the engineer and owner of the studio, handed out headsets and checked and adjusted the microphones. The moment was awkward for me. It had been almost 3 months since Robinson Felder's attempted abduction. In that time, I had only seen Rachel once, and that was when she had come to my apartment to collect some clothes she had left there. We were no longer seeing each other, despite my apologizing and taking back the accusation I had made against her on that last night. As she had warned, my accusation ruined everything. We were now finished. Getting her to appear on the final podcast took an email lobbying campaign that was a digital version of begging and groveling. I could have easily proceeded without her on the episode, but I hoped that getting her into the same room with me might spark something, or at least give me the chance to once more confess my sins and seek forgiveness and understanding. It wasn't a complete shutdown of communications, because we were still inextricably bound together by the shrike. She was my source. She had access to Metz and the FBI investigation. I had access to her. Though we communicated by email only, it was still communication, and more than once I had tried to engage her in a discussion outside the bounds of the source-reporter relationship, but she had thwarted and deflected such efforts, with the request that we keep things on a professional level from now on. I watched her as Ray positioned the microphone in front of her lips and had her say her name a few times while he checked the sound levels. She avoided eye contact with me the whole time. Looking back, I was as mystified by this turn of events as by anything else that had occurred in the case. I could not figure out what I had or didn't have inside me that would lead me to doubt a sure thing and look for the cracks in its foundation. Once we went live, I began with the scripted intro I used at the start of every episode of the podcast. Death is my beat. I make my living from it. I forge my professional reputation on it. I'm Jack McAvoy, and this is Murder Beat, the true crime podcast that takes you beyond the headlines and on the trail of a killer with the investigators on the case. This episode wraps up our first season with a live discussion featuring the investigators, attorneys, and journalists who all played a part in exposing and hunting a serial killer known as the Shrike. And so it went. I introduced the panel members and started taking listener questions. Most of them were routine softballs. I acted as moderator and chose which participant to throw each question to. Everybody had been prepped beforehand to keep their answers short and precise. The shorter the answer, the more questions we could get to. I directed more than an equal share to Rachel, thinking that somehow it was like engaging her in conversation. But it felt hollow and embarrassing after a while. The most unusual call came from a woman identifying herself as Charisse. She did not ask a question about the Shrike case. Instead, she said that 11 years earlier, her sister Kylie had been abducted and murdered, her body left in the sand under the Venice Pier. She said the police never arrested anyone for the crime, and there was no active investigation she knew of. "My question is whether you would investigate her case," Charisse said. The question was so out of left field that I struggled to answer. "Well," I said, "I could probably look into it and check on what the police did with it, but I'm not a detective." "What about the Shrike?" Charisse said. "You investigated him." "The circumstances were a bit different. I was working on a story, and it became a serial murder case. I was interrupted by a dial tone. Charisse had hung up. I got the discussion back on track after that, but the episode still went long. The advertised hour stretched to 90 minutes, and the only time we veered away from questions from listeners was when I had to read advertisements from our sponsors, which were mostly other true crime podcasts. The listeners who called in were enthusiastic about Murder Beat, and many eagerly asked what the next season would be about and when it would start. These were questions I didn't yet have an official response to, but it was good to know that there appeared to be an audience out there waiting. It buoyed my sinking morale. I have to admit that I secretly hoped that I would hear from him, the Shrike. I had hoped that he was one of the podcast's listeners and that he would feel compelled to call in to taunt or threaten the journalists or the investigators. That was why I let the session go long. I wanted to get every caller just in case he was there waiting to speak. But it never happened. And when we answered the last question and killed the live feed, I looked across the table at Metz. We had talked previously about the possibility of the unsub, FBI speak for the unknown subject, calling in. He shook his head at me, and I shrugged. I glanced at Rachel, who was sitting next to Metz. She was already taking her headphones off. I then saw her touch his arm and lean toward him to whisper something. The gesture looked intimate to me. My morale sagged further. I wrapped things up with my usual thanks to those involved in the podcast, the participants, the sponsors, the studio, and the sound engineer. I promised listeners that we would be back with a new chapter in the Shrike case as soon as anything occurred. We went out with a tune from saxophonist Grace Kelly called By the Grave. And that was it. I took my headphones off and draped them over the microphone stand. The others did the same. Thanks, everybody, I said. That was good. I was hoping the Shrike would call in, but he was probably busy doing laundry today. It was a lame and insensitive attempt at a joke. No one even smiled. I have to go to the restroom, Rachel said, so I'm going to leave. Good to see everybody. She gave me a smile as she stood up, but I couldn't hang my hope on it. I watched her leave the recording room. Gaspar and Ruiz were the next to leave, as they each had to drive all the way back to Orange County. I asked Ray if Emily was still on the line, but he said she had disconnected. Myron bailed next, and then Metz. I was left with Ray, who had questions about whether I wanted him to edit the session down to an hour or post it in its entirety as the season finale. I told him to put the whole thing out. Those who hadn't listened to the live version could download the whole thing and listen to as much or as little as they liked. I took the elevator down to the building's basement. The garage was always crowded, requiring an attendant named Rodrigo to be constantly moving double-parked cars around so people could get in and get out. When the elevator opened, I saw through the alcove that Rachel was in the garage waiting with Metz for their cars. I hung back for a moment. I wasn't sure why. I thought if Metz got his car first, I would have a chance to talk to Rachel and maybe ask for a meeting to clear the air about what was happening with us. In the last month, I had used the ad revenues from the podcast both to lease a new car and rent a bigger apartment. After 10 years with the ragtag Jeep, I had gotten a new car, a Range Rover SUV that was the very picture of maturity and security. I thought maybe we could leave Rachel's car in the garage and go up the street to Miceli's for an afternoon glass of wine. But I was wrong. Rodrigo brought up a car that I recognized as a Fed vehicle, and both of them walked toward it, Rachel to the passenger door. That told me more than I wanted to know. Embarrassed, I waited until they were pulling away before passing through the alcove into the garage. But I timed it wrong. Just as I stepped out, Rachel turned in her seat to reach back over her shoulder for the seatbelt. Our eyes caught, and she smiled as the Fed car pulled away. I took it as an apology smile and a goodbye look. Rodrigo came up behind me. "Mr. Jack," he said, "you're all set. First row, keys on the front tire for you." "Thank you, Rodrigo," I said, still watching Metz's car as it turned out of the garage onto Cahuenga. Once it was gone from sight, I walked alone to my car. Chapter 44. I decided I had nowhere to go but home. I pulled out onto Cahuenga and headed north. I followed the road as it made the big bend west until it became Ventura Boulevard, and I was in Studio City. My new place was a two-bedroom apartment on Vineland. I was thinking about what I had just seen in the parking garage and how I should interpret it I wasn't paying attention to the road and didn't register the brake lights in front of me. My new SUV's anti-collision system engaged, and a sharp alarm issued from the dashboard. I came out of my reverie and slammed the brake pedal with both feet. The SUV came skidding to a halt 2 feet from the Prius stopped in front of me. I felt the dull thud of an impact behind me. Shit! I settled down and checked the rearview mirror, then got out to inspect the damage. I walked to the back of the car and saw that the car behind me was a good 6 feet away. The back of my car had no sign of damage. I looked at the other driver. His window was down. "Did you hit me?" I asked. "No, I didn't hit you," he said indignantly. I checked the back of my car again. I still had a temporary tag on the car. "Hey, buddy, how about you get in your pretty new car and keep moving?" the other driver said. "You're holding up traffic with this bullshit." I waved him and his rudeness off and climbed back into the driver's seat, confused by the whole situation. I continued driving, thinking about what had happened. I had definitely felt some kind of heavy thud of impact when I hit the brakes. I wondered if something was wrong or loose in the new car, then thought about IKEA. My new apartment was nearly twice the size of my old one. It had dictated the need for more furniture, and I had made several runs to the IKEA in Burbank since getting the new SUV, making good use of the rear storage compartment. But I was sure I had not left anything back there. The compartment was empty, or it should have been. Then it hit me. I checked the rearview mirror, but this time was more interested in what was on my side of the back window than behind my car. The pullover cover for the rear compartment was in place. Nothing seemed amiss. I pulled my phone and speed dialed Rachel. The ringing came blaring out of the car stereo surround sound. I had forgot about the Bluetooth connection the car salesman had set up for me when I took delivery of the car. I quickly hit the button on the dash that killed the sound system. The buzzing returned to only my phone and my ear. But Rachel didn't answer. She was probably still with Metz and thought I was calling for some kind of maudlin, let's get back together conversation. It went to her voicemail, and I disconnected. I called again, and while I waited, I reached over to my laptop on the seat next to me and opened it. I knew I had Metz's cell number in a file on the desktop, but this time Rachel answered. "Jack, this is not a good time." I slapped the laptop closed and spoke in a low voice. "Are you with Metz?" "Jack, I'm not going to talk about who I don't mean that way. Are you still driving with Metz?" I checked the rear view again and realized I had to stop talking out loud. "Yes," Rachel said. "He's just taking me back to my office." "Check your messages," I said. I disconnected. Traffic slowed again as I came to the intersection with Vineland. I used the moment to type out a text to Rachel. "I'm in my car. Strike is hiding in the back." I realized after I sent it that autocorrect had changed shrike to strike. I figured, though, that she would understand. She did, and I got an almost immediate response. "Are you sure? Where are you?" I was coming up to my apartment building but drove by it and typed in a reply. "Vineland." My phone buzzed, and Rachel's name was on the screen. I connected but didn't say hello. "Jack?" I coughed and hoped she understood I did not want to reveal I was on the phone to the person hiding in the back. "Okay, I get it," Rachel said. "You can't talk, so listen. You have two choices. You get to a populated area, pull into a parking lot where there are people, and just get out and get away from the car. Give me the location and we will try to get the police there and hopefully catch him." She waited a moment for any sort of response before going to choice two. She must have registered my continuing silence as interest in the alternate plan. "Okay. The other thing is, we make damn sure we get him. You drive to a destination, and we set up a horseshoe like we did before, and we finally get this guy. This choice is more risky to you, of course, But I think if you keep the car moving, he's not going to make a move. He's going to wait. She waited. I said nothing. So, Jack, do this. Cough once if you want the first choice. Don't cough, don't do anything if you want to go with the second. I realized that if I took any time to consider my options, my silence would confirm that I was going with the riskier second option. But that was okay. In that moment, I flashed on a vision of Gwyneth Rice in her hospital bed, surrounded by tubes and machines, and her electronic plea that we not take the shrike alive. I wanted the second option. Okay, Jack, option two, Rachel said. Cough now if I have it wrong. I was silent, and Rachel accepted the confirmation. You need to get on the 101 and head south, she said. We were just on it, and it's wide open. You'll be able to get to Hollywood, and by then we'll have a plan. We're turning around, and we'll be there. I was coming up to a southbound entrance to the 170 freeway. I knew it merged with the 101 less than a mile south. Rachel continued. I'm going to keep the line open while Matt sets things up. He's talking to LAPD. They'll be able to mobilize quicker. You just have to stay in motion. He won't try anything while the car is moving. I nodded, even though I knew she couldn't see me. But if something happens and you have to stop, just get out of the car and get clear. Get safe, Jack. I need you to be safe. I registered the quiet, more intimate tone in her voice and wanted to respond. I hoped my silence communicated something, but just as quickly, doubt started to move into my mind. Had I left something in the storage compartment? Had the thud I felt simply come from a pothole in the road? I was mobilizing the FBI and LAPD on what amounted to a hunch. I was beginning to wish I had just coughed once and pointed the car toward the North Hollywood Police Division. Okay, Jack, Rachel said, her voice modulated back to a command tone. I'll get back to you when we have it set up. I got lucky and saw up ahead that I had a green light to turn into the freeway entrance. Doubt aside, I made the turn. The freeway entrance looped around, and then I was heading south on the 170. I took one of the 101 merge lanes and got the car up to 60. Rachel had been right. The freeway was moderately crowded, but the traffic was moving. It was pre-rush hour, and most of the traffic was going northbound out of downtown to the suburbs in the valley and beyond. Once I merged onto the 101, I worked my way over to the fast lane and stayed in the flow, now moving at 50 miles per hour. I checked the rear view every few seconds and kept the phone to my left ear. I could hear Metz's voice as he talked on another phone in the car with Rachel. It was muffled, and I couldn't make out everything he said, but I could definitely read the urgency in his tone. Soon I was into the Cahuenga Pass and could see the Capitol Records building ahead. I was putting the picture together as I waited for Rachel to come back on the line and tell me the plan. I realized that the Shrike was a listener of the podcast after all, and I had given him everything he needed. At the end of each episode, I had plugged the recording studio when I thanked Ray Stallings. I had then repeatedly promoted the time and date of the live roundtable discussion that would be the final episode. The Shrike then only had to surveil the building where Sunray Studios were located to figure out how he could use the parking garage situation to his advantage. The attendant left the keys of the cars he moved around on each vehicle's front right tire. The Shrike could have snuck in while Rodrigo was shuffling cars, used the key to unlock my Range Rover, and then secreted himself in the back. I suddenly realized there was another possibility. I had broadcast the podcast's time and location to everybody. It was possible that if someone was concealed in the back, it wasn't the Shrike. It could be another crazy incel like Robinson Felder. I took the phone from my ear to try to text this possibility to Rachel when I heard her voice again. Jack, I waited. We have a plan. We want you to get to Sunset Boulevard and take the exit. It dumps you out on Van Ness at an intersection with Harold Way. Take the immediate right onto Harold Way, and we'll be set up for you. LAPD has got 2 units there right now, and more are on the way. Matt and I are 2 minutes out. Clear your throat if you understand, and we are good to go. I waited a beat, and then cleared my throat loudly. I was good to go. Okay, Jack. Now what I want you to do is try to text me a description of what you're driving. I know you mentioned in a recent email that you got a new car. Give me make, model, and color. Color is important, Jack. We want to know what we've got coming. Also put in what exit you last passed, so we'll have a sense of timing. Go ahead, but be careful. Don't wreck while texting. I pulled the phone away and typed the needed information into a text to her, cycling my focus repeatedly from the phone to the rear view to the road ahead. I had just sent off the text, including the fact that I was about to pass the Highland exit, when my eyes went to the road ahead and I saw brake lights flaring across all lanes. Traffic was stopping. Chapter 45. There was an accident ahead. My SUV gave me a view over the roof lines of several cars in front of me, and I could see smoke and a car turned sideways, blocking the fast lane and left shoulder of the freeway. I knew I had to get to the right before I was stopped dead in the backup. I hit the turn signal and almost blindly started pushing across 4 lanes of the slowing traffic. My moves brought a chorus of horns from angry motorists who were trying to do the same thing I was. The traffic slowed to a crawl, and the spaces between cars compressed, but nobody on the road had the kind of emergency I had. I didn't care about their frustrations or horns. "Jack," Rachel said, "I hear the horns. What is—" "I know you can't talk. Try to text. We got the info you sent. Try to tell me what's going on now." I did what most LA drivers do when they're alone in their cars. I cursed the traffic. "God damn it, why are we stopping?" I had 1 lane left to get over to, and I believed it would be the fastest way around the accident backup. I didn't trust the mirrors anymore, and was turning half in my seat to check my competition through the windows, all the while keeping the phone to my ear. "Okay, Jack, I get it," Rachel said. "But ride on the shoulder, do whatever you have to do, and get down here." I coughed once, not knowing at this point if that meant yes or no. All I knew was that I had to get around the backup. Once I got past the crash, the freeway would be wide open and I'd be flying. I had slowed past the Highland exit and could see that the accident scene was a couple hundred yards ahead and before the Vine Street exit. That was where traffic came to a complete halt. Now I could see people getting out of their cars and standing in the freeway. Cars were moving inch by inch as they passed the smoking wreckage. I could hear a siren coming up behind me and knew the arrival of first responders would shut things down even further and for longer. I also knew I could go to those first responders with the deadly cargo I believed I was carrying. But would they understand what I had? Would they capture him? I was considering these options and the last mile I had to go to Sunset Boulevard when there was a loud thwack from the back of my car. I turned around fully and saw that the spring-loaded cover to the rear storage area had been released and had snapped back into its housing like a window shade. A figure rose from the space. A man. He looked around as if to get his bearings, then must have seen through the rear windows that the siren he had heard was from a rescue ambulance making its way to the crash site. He then turned and looked directly at me.
"Hello, Jack. Where are we going?"
"Who the fuck are you?" I said. "What do you want?"
"I think you know who I am and what I want."
He started climbing over the rear seats. I dropped the phone and pinned the accelerator. The car lurched forward and I yanked the wheel to the right. I clipped the right corner of the car in front of me as the SUV veered onto the freeway shoulder. The wheels spun on the loose gravel and litter before finding purchase. In the rear view, I saw the intruder thrown backward into the space where he had been hiding. But he quickly reemerged and started climbing over the seats again.
Slow it down, Jack. What's the hurry?
I didn't answer. My mind was racing faster than the car as I tried to think of an escape plan. The Vine Street exit was just past the accident site. But what did that get me? My choices seemed simple in that adrenalized moment. Fight or flight. Keep moving or stop the car and get out and run. In the back of my mind, I knew one thing. Running away meant the Shrike would escape again. I kept my foot on the pedal. With less than 100 yards before I would clear the traffic back up and get off the shoulder, a beat-up pickup truck filled with lawn equipment suddenly pulled onto the shoulder ahead of me at a much slower pace. I yanked the wheel right again and tried to squeeze by without losing speed. My car scraped sharply along a concrete sound barrier that bordered the freeway and then rebounded into the side of the pickup, pushing it into the cars to its left. A full chorus of horns and crashing metal followed, but my car kept moving. I straightened the wheel and checked the mirror. The man behind me had been thrown to the floor of the back seat. 2 seconds later, I was past the traffic backup, and there were 5 lanes of open freeway in front of me. But I was still half a mile from the Sunset exit and knew that I could not hold off the Shrike for that long. The phone was somewhere in the car, and Rachel was presumably still listening. I made what I thought might be a last call out to her. "Rachel!" I yelled. An arm came around my neck and choked off my voice. My head was snapped back against the headrest. I reached up with one hand and tried to pull it off my neck, but the Shrike had locked his arm and was tightening the pressure.
"Stop the car,"
he said in my ear. I planted my feet and pushed back into the seat, trying to make space against his forearm. The car picked up speed.
"Stop the car,"
he said again. I realized one thing. I had a seatbelt on, and he didn't. I remembered the salesman droning on about the safety and construction of the car. Something about rollover protection. But I had not been interested. I just wanted to sign the papers and drive away, not listen to things that would never matter to me. Now they did. I felt the car automatically lowering into its high-speed profile as the digital speedometer clicked past 85. I let go of my attacker's forearm, put both hands on the wheel, and yanked it to the left. The car jerked wildly to the left, and then the forces of physics took over. For a split second, it held the road, then the front left wheel came off the surface, and the back left followed. I believe the car became airborne by at least a few feet, and then flipped side over side before impacting and continuing to rotate, tumbling down the freeway. Everything seemed to move in slow motion, my body jolting in all directions with each crashing impact. I felt the arm that had been around my neck fall away. I heard the loud tearing of metal and the explosive shattering of glass. Debris flew around in the car and out the now glass-free windows. My laptop hit me in the ribs, and at some point, I blacked out. When I came to, I was hanging upside down in my seat. I looked down at the ceiling of the car and saw that I was dripping blood on it. I reached to my face and located the source, a long gash on the top of my head. I wondered what had happened. Had somebody hit me? Had I hit somebody? Then I remembered the Shrike. I looked around as best as I could. I didn't see him. The rear seats of the car had broken loose in the accident and were now tilted down to the ceiling, obstructing my view. "Shit," I said. I could taste blood in my mouth. I became aware of a sharp pain in my side and remembered my laptop. It had hit me in the ribs. I put my left hand down on the ceiling to brace myself and used the other to release my seatbelt. My arm wasn't strong enough, and I crashed down to the ceiling, my leg still tangled with the steering column. I slowly lowered myself the rest of the way. As I did, I became aware of a tinny voice calling my name. I looked around and saw my cell phone on the asphalt about 4 feet outside the front window. The screen was spiderwebbed with cracks, but I could read the name, Rachel, on it. The call was still active. Once my legs were free, I crawled through the space where the windshield had been and reached for my phone. Rachel.
Jack, are you all right? What happened?
We crashed. I'm bleeding.
We're on our way. Where is the unsub?
The... what?
The Shrike, Jack. Do you see him?
Now I remembered the arm around my neck. The Shrike. He was going to kill me. I crawled all the way out of the wreck and unsteadily stood up by the front end of the upside-down Range Rover. I saw people running down the shoulder of the freeway toward me. There was a car with flashing blue lights working its way down as well. I took a few uneasy steps and realized there was something wrong with one of my feet. Every step sent a jolt of pain from my left ankle up to my hip. Nevertheless, I kept moving around the wreckage and looking through the windows into the back. There was no sign of anyone else, but the car was canted unevenly on the ground. When the people got to the car, I heard shrieks of panic.
We have to move this! He's underneath!
I limped around to their side and saw what they saw. The car was resting unevenly on the roadway because the Shrike was underneath it. I could see his hand extending out from the edge of the roof. I carefully lowered myself to the asphalt and looked under the wreck. The Shrike was crushed under the car. His face was turned toward me, and his eyes were open, one of them staring lifelessly, the other in a broken orbit and at an off angle.
Help me push this off him!
Somebody yelled to the others running to the scene. I started to get up. Don't bother, I said. It's too late. The End. Chapter 46. As of now, they don't know the identity of the man who was crushed under my car. We can't put a true name to him. There was no identification in the gray hoodie he wore or the pockets of his pants. His fingerprints and DNA were submitted by the FBI to every available database in the world and produced no match. An extensive and thorough search of a mile-wide grid around the Sunray Studios building found no abandoned vehicle and only a gas station camera that captured an out-of-focus angle on a man in a gray hoodie crossing east to west over the 101 freeway on the Barham Boulevard overpass. He was moving in the direction of the studio an hour before the live podcast, but a new grid search on the east side of the freeway produced no vehicle and no record of a drop-off by any car service. Examination of the body during autopsy revealed a prior surgery to repair a broken arm bone called the radius. It appeared to have been a childhood injury, a spiral fracture, which is an indication of abuse. There was limited dental work. What was there appeared to be distinctly American, but not enough to successfully trace X-rays to a specific dentist or patient. As of now, the Shrike remains a cipher in death. Most likely, it will remain that way. In the parlance of the newspaper business, he is now off the front page. The public's moment of grim fascination with him dissipated like smoke curling away from a cigarette as the focus of the media moved on. The Shrike had flown beneath the radar for most of his existence. He returned there after his run was over. With the Shrike no longer a threat, Emily Atwater returned from the UK, having found that she missed Los Angeles. And with the ending to the story I had provided on the 101 freeway, she was able to complete the book.
She then returned a fair warning as its senior staff writer, and I know Myron was happy about that. Still, I remained haunted by not knowing who the Shrike was and what made him a killer of women. To me, that left the story unfinished. It was a question that would remain in my mind forever. The whole story changed me. I wondered often about what might have been if I had not happened to go on a date with Christina Potrero, if my name had not come up in the LAPD investigation, and Mattson and Sakai had not followed me into the garage that night. Would the Shrike still be out there below the radar? Would Hammond and Vogel still be operating Dirty Four on the dark web? And would William Orton still be selling the DNA of unsuspecting women to them? These were scary thoughts, but also inspiring ones. They made me think about all the unsolved cases out there, all the failures of justice, and all of the mothers, fathers, and families who had lost loved ones. I thought about Charisse, who had called the podcast, and wished there was a way to reach out to her. I knew then that I could no longer be an observer, a journalist who wrote about these things or talked about them in a podcast. I knew that I could not be a sideline reporter. I needed to be in the game. On the first working day of the new year, I drove downtown in my replacement Range Rover, found parking, and walked into the offices of Raw Data in the Mercantile Bank building. I asked to speak to Rachel, and soon enough was directed back to her office. We had not spoken since the day the Shrike had been killed. I didn't bother to sit down. I expected this to be quick. "What's up?" she asked tentatively. "I have an idea, and I want you to hear me out," I said.
"I'm listening."
"I don't want to just tell murder stories on the podcast. I want to solve them."
"What do you mean?"
"What I said. I want to work murders on the podcast. We bring in a case, a cold case, discuss it, work it, solve it. I want you to be part of it. You profile the cases, then we go to work on them."
"Jack, you're not..."
"It doesn't matter that I'm not police. We live in digital times. The police are analog. We can put things together. Remember that woman who called the podcast, Charisse? She said nobody's working that case. We could."
"You're talking about being amateur detectives.
You're not an amateur, and I know when we were working on the Shrike, you loved it. You were back doing what you were meant to do. I took that away from you, but now I'm offering it back."
"It's not the same, Jack."
"No, it's better, because we have no rules." She said nothing. "Anybody can run background checks," I said, "but you have a gift. I saw it with the Shrike."
"And you're saying this would be a podcast?" she asked.
"We meet, talk about the case, record, and post it. The advertising will fund the investigations."
"It seems kind of crazy.
There's a podcast out there about a housewife who got a serial killer to confess." "Nothing is crazy. This could work."
"And where do these cases come from?"
"Anywhere, everywhere. Google. I'm going to find the case Charisse called about, her sister's case." Rachel was silent for a long moment before responding.
"Jack, is this..."
"No, it's not a lame attempt to get back with you. I know I ruined it. I accept that. This is exactly what I just said it is. A podcast. We go after those who think they got away with it." She didn't respond at first, but I thought I saw her almost nod when I had spoken. "I'll think about it," she finally said. "Okay, that's all I ask," I said. "Just don't think too long." Having made the pitch, I turned and left the office without a further word. I walked out of the elegant old building and onto Main Street. There was a chill in the January air, but the sun was out, and it was going to be a good year. I headed down the street to my car. My phone buzzed before I got to it. It was Rachel.
Author's note. This book is a work of fiction, but Fair Warning is a real news site offering tough watchdog reporting on consumer issues. It is a nonprofit founded and edited by Myron Levin. The author is a member of Fair Warning's board of directors. Fair Warning and Myron Levin's name were used with permission. Go to fairwarning.org for further information and to consider making a donation to support its important work. The genetic research explored in this novel is based on fact and current understanding of the human genome. The reporting regarding government oversight of the genetic analytics industry is also based on current standards. Any errors or omissions are strictly the fault of the author. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Fair Warning, written by Michael Connolly, read by Peter Giles and Zach Vila. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Sound editing by Christine Farrell. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. Recorded at Literati Audio Studios. Fair Warning is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2020 by Hieronymus Incorporated. Audio production copyright 2020 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Hi, this is Michael Connolly, author of the book you just listened to, and we have an audiobook extra here in that I'm sitting with Myron Levin, founder and editor of Fair Warning, the consumer watchdog website. Now, I know you're probably thinking, wait, Fair Warning is a novel about Jack McAvoy working as a reporter for a news site called Fair Warning and an editor named Myron Levin. Well, you're right, but the fictional exploits of Jack McAvoy are set in the real world of contemporary journalism, where much of the best reporting is done by nonprofit independent news sites like Fair Warning. So I've mixed fact and fiction here in this book, and we're going to talk about that. Full disclosure, though, I've known Myron for more than 30 years, since the days we both worked in the Valley Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. And when he created Fair Warning a number of years ago, he asked me to be a board member. And I have to say, it's one of the things I'm most proud of in my life, because Fair Warning does some really good work, and I'm glad to be a small part of it. All of this, it probably explains why I was allowed to use Fair Warning and Myron in my book of fiction. So we're going to talk for a few minutes here about the book and the website, and we hope you enjoy it. First of all, I got to say, correct me if I get anything wrong here. So I'm alternately calling this a website, a news site. How would you say I should refer to Fair Warning?
Well, we refer to it as a news organization. It's all those other things, too.
All right. So news organization is the umbrella term, and I'll try to remember that.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you about a dozen questions here, some softballs, some maybe a little more difficult because they're going to get into the culture of news in our time now, the culture of media. But let me start off with an easy one, a question that I bet you've never been asked before, Myron. How does it feel to be a character in a novel?
It's true I've never been asked, because this is a one-of-a-kind experience. I mean, it's beyond unexpected, I would say, and it's exciting.
We're recording this a couple months prior to the publication of the book. But do you think or hope the book will spur interest in the real news organization called Fair Warning?
I don't think it can it can't but help to raise our profile and make more people aware of us and the important work we do. How many of those people are converted into readers and supporters? I don't know, but it's going to help. I know.
I'm good. I'm glad to be part of that then. Why did you start Fair Warning? And when did you start it? How old is it?
It's going to be 10 years old. And as we sit here in the very start of March, it's going to be 10 years old in 3 weeks. So we launched in early 2010. And why did I start it? I had quit the Los Angeles Times, taken a buyout, gotten some severance. So I had at least a few months to figure out what was next for me. I wasn't retiring. I wanted another chapter. And I really had cast around looking at a few different possibilities. And this was one of them. And I actually thought this was more of a long shot than the others, because it seemed like everyone then was walking around with their hand out trying to get money to start a nonprofit news organization. I had, as a Los Angeles Times reporter, scrupulously avoided becoming socially engaged with anybody that I covered or might cover. So although there was a lot of wealth in this town, I didn't know those people. So I thought it was a real long shot. But, you know, we got the money to start. And, you know, why did I even want to do it? You know, already then, although things – the downturn has accelerated since then, because this was 2008, 9, 10 – there were too few people doing deeply reported stories on topics that involved, you know, life and death matters for consumers that held large businesses and regulators to account. And things were getting worse as newsrooms imploded all over the country. And so we started Fair Warning to try to make a difference and at least fill a little bit of that gap.
Along the same lines, I want to hear your pitch on what makes Fair Warning important and where its place is in the media culture.
Well, as I mentioned before, I mean, I think we focus on public health, consumer, environmental, and labor issues and related topics of government and business accountability. And these subjects were never covered enough, even in the fatter, happier days of traditional media. And so it takes Fair Warning and others like us, you know, to fill that gap. And I think, you know, nonprofit news is and will continue to be an even bigger part of, you know, keeping alive, you know, tenacious watchdog journalism in this country. As far as that goes, the subjects we cover are not really the focus of any other news organization. There is some overlap, of course, but we think, you know, we occupy kind of an important place in this growing nonprofit news firmament of covering you know, public health, consumer, environmental, and labor issues, and always doing, you know, our stories or our best stories are accountability stories that call out business and government over harm or potential harm to the public.
Your answer is the reason I wanted to put Jack McAvoy into Fair Warning in this novel. It wasn't like, oh, I know this guy, he'll let me use it. It was more like about what you were doing, which I think is important. And it was important for me to get Jack into that kind of situation. I first wrote about Jack about 25 years ago. And at that time, the newspaper business was fat and happy. I mean, I remember at the LA Times, they sent me to Florida once on a murder story, and they flew me first class. You know, when was the last time that ever happened?
Right.
You know, so the internet back then was nascent. There was no AOL, no public embrace of the internet, no technical, techno-cultural revolution yet. But I have continued to write about Jack and the media business over time, and in subsequent books, I've tried to follow the changes in the business as a built-in theme to the books. In The Scarecrow, which came out about 10 or 11 years ago, the theme was the collapse of the newspaper business and the transition to the internet as a means by which people were getting their news. And this coincides with the start of Fair Warning, by the way. And with the new book, Fair Warning, I have Jack working on an internet news site, a news organization, as you said earlier, called Fair Warning. And I continue with the theme. And where I think Jack is where I think we all are now as consumers of news. And so I guess this leads to the question, maybe completely unanswerable, but what is next? Is it this how it will be for the foreseeable future? Or do you see another major shift in how news is produced and consumed coming?
I'm not much on predictions, frankly. I mean, I think the salvation of a lot of traditional newspapers, particularly Metro daily newspapers, is going to have to be putting them in the hands of nonprofit foundations. I mean, I'm not saying this will happen, but this would be how to keep them alive. I see, you know, nonprofit news as being a growing ever-growing importance. I think the real question is, I mean, first of all, I think, you know, many of us would agree that, you know, tough fact-based journalism is, you know, vital to a democracy. I mean, particularly, you know, one on the ropes as ours might be. And nonprofit news is going to have to be a big part of that if it's going to happen. You know, to counter all the, you know, sensational clickbait and fact-free rants that are increasingly filling the news space. And it really is a matter of how much the public will value journalism and embrace, you know, the nonprofit model as something they need to support just the way they support homeless shelters or scholarship programs for low-income kids or, you know, animal welfare, these kind of things that are clearly charities in people's minds. Sometimes someone may support them or support something else or support the arts, but they recognize that to keep them alive and vibrant, it takes philanthropic effort. And I think that sadly, that's kind of where we are in journalism. It's hard for people to get their heads around it, I think, because for so many years, the traditional media made egregious profits just selling ads and subscriptions, and you know that no longer works. So I can't really predict. I guess I'm not answering your question. I think the state of journalism in 10 or 20 years will depend on this evolution toward the nonprofit model, and foundations and individuals recognizing the importance of strong fact-based journalism and ponying up to support it, really.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're answering the question. I think it is moving more and more there. And, it's going to be up to the consumer for the most part to determine, what is
exactly
legit, what is unbiased, what is not a front for corporations or business or government.
And just on that, I mean, just let me say that, I know we had somebody working with us a few years ago, and she was trying to write a pitch for trying to attract supporters. And she wrote something about our reputation for integrity. And I said, we don't need to put that in there. That's baseline. The bottom line is, of course, journalism organizations are trying to be fact-based and trying to be honest. Everybody understands that. It's not much of a claim. Well, increasingly, it's a claim.
Right. Yeah.
It's something people, know that it isn't automatic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like, the FBI seal, which is like integrity and all that stuff.
Yes.
You got to almost put that out there nowadays. When you agreed to be a character in the book and the board approved me using Fair Warning, I made no promise to you of any kind of editorial input or other than my promise that was that I was going to let you read the manuscript before it got published. You did that. And I appreciate that. And you came back with many great notes that I incorporated and became part of the finished book. It made it more accurate and better. In the book, you are depicted, the fictional Myron Levin, is depicted as a guy with his feet in two camps. He's a veteran journalist, has done a lot of great work, but he also runs this thing and has to get money to keep it going. So what is the hardest part about your job right now? Is it getting the money to keep it going or getting the stories that are important that nobody has gotten yet and that also keeps you going?
I'd say both. It's really hard to discriminate there. You know, having these two major jobs is certainly a challenge. If I didn't have them both, I might do a better job of it. I think, you know, obviously you have to be able to pay people and pay your office rent and pay for insurance and all the things that it takes to run even a small organization. So, fundraising is a constant need. And getting the stories also. I mean, you know, the other thing too is just we're all in an environment. I mean, all, you know, whether we're Fair Warning or the New York Times, where there's just less and less transparency. Just getting information out of major institutions is harder than ever. And I partly blame, you know, the internet for that. It gives large organizations the opportunity to throw something out on a website and say they're being responsive, but just getting people to have a conversation with you, getting an interview with the subject expert at a company or a government agency is really hard. So getting the stories is really hard. And also when you're small, you have to make sure that you're doing things that are either exclusives or you're greatly advancing whatever topic it is that you're writing about, because if nobody needs to read something that we do that's 5% better or 5% worse than other larger organizations have done. The other thing is that we live not only on our website, but on the pages of many other partner media, because we aggressively distribute our stories to media around the country. And why should they take anything from us that is pretty much what they could grab off Reuters or Associated Press? So it's hard to get the kind of stories that we do, and even hard to choose the ones that will really make a difference, where we can really make a difference with our, you know, somewhat modest resources.
So for someone listening who has not checked out Fair Warning before and is just finding out that it's a real thing, how do you get to Fair Warning? Can you subscribe to it? What's the website? And where do you go if you want to support the cause?
Well, first of all, the URL, the web address is www.fairwarning.org. You can go on there and see what we do. There are links on there to subscribe. You just put your email in. We have a email newsletter that we distribute when typically when we put out a news story, we write a little summary of it, a little blurb. We send it out to people on that newsletter list, and so you can keep track of what we're doing that way just by going on the site and signing up to subscribe. And if you want to support, there's also a donate page where you can, you know, go on and give money. And, well, you know, you're all welcome.
Yes. going back to the book for a second, another theme in the McAvoy stories is about technology. I've only written 3 full McAvoy books, although he's appeared in cameos in a few other books. But over the last 25 years, it's been these 3 books. And I'd say the continuing theme in all 3 is about technology and the idea that for every great stride we make in technology, there's always going to be somebody out there who will try to turn it somehow against us. In Fair Warning, it is the human genome and this explosion of DNA analytics that is almost completely unregulated by our government agencies. I mean, when I wrote this book and did research and I had some researchers working with me, that to me was the biggest shock, that this is pretty much unregulated. And so I'm always throwing out the net looking for good ideas. And when I came across some reporting on this, it sparked the story of the novel. And the next step was to decide where Jack would be and how he would get into the story. And I decided on it being with Fair Warning, you know, if you people, the board and you would have me. And now that you've read the book, do you think what Jack pursues here is a legitimate Fair Warning story?
I'm glad you chose us. I think it turned out to be because of the facts he discovered about these crimes and how they were being done. It turned into a story about consumer welfare, as well as a story about a serial killer. So, you know, there were doubts in the beginning that it was anything but a straight murder mystery, which we don't cover.
Oh, it's, you sound like the guy in the book.
Yes. Yes.
But I'm glad to finally check that box of consumer welfare.
Yes. No, I think it definitely was. I mean, and I, you know, I've wanted to ask you just how you came up with this idea. I mean, it's really compelling and you know, tremendous. And not only the idea of the leaking of this data and its use and misuse by people that aren't supposed to have it, but this, even this gruesome way of killing that this murderer did.
Oh, the gruesome stuff just comes out of my imagination. That's the easy stuff. But now there was actually I get story ideas from all kinds of places. Normally people tell me a story that I expand, but every now and then I'll pick off something out of the media. And there was a story about the Pentagon telling members of the armed forces not to submit their DNA to these analytic firms because of the lack of security and government, you know, watching over this. And that made me do some more investigation. I read a couple books and so forth. And I can't remember exactly where it was, whether it was an interview or a book, but there was – and it comes out in Fair Warning in the novel. But there was this question that, you know, right now our DNA, you know, we've barely tapped into what's going to happen with people's DNA. And what if someday you don't carry a driver's license and your DNA is your way of identifying yourself, paying your bills and so forth? That is who you are. And 20 years ago, you just gave your DNA away, you know, to an analytics firm that you sign a 6-page, you know, disclosure. So I'm not trying to put those people out of business. I'm saying and I'm not even trying to say anything with this book. My job is a commercial thriller writer, but I do try to bring in, you know, the real world and real issues into what I'm writing. And to me, there's some questions here. You know, the FDA is supposedly in charged with oversight in this world, but it's taken a back seat and it's watching. And so I basically, it almost seems like the government is waiting for something to go wrong and then they'll step in. And it just seems like there's a better way of doing it than waiting for something to go wrong. So anyway, let's get back to the real world here for a minute. Is there a particular story, Fair Warning is broken, now that we're coming up on the 10th anniversary, happy birthday. Is there one – I mean, there's probably many. Obviously, there's many. But is there one you want to talk about, the story that you guys broke that maybe the Washington Post and other media outlets had to follow that had a big impact and that you're most proud of?
Well, there's so many stories that at least we thought were really, really strong. I remember one of the most unique stories we did, and I don't know what kind of impact it did, but it was – certainly highly original, was sort of historically the billboard industry's war on trees all over the place. Billboard companies, you know, sometimes illegally cutting down or poisoning trees so that there'd be no obstructed views of their billboards. I mean, nobody had ever really written a big story about that. We did some stories about here's a story we did that we were very proud of. We wrote some stories about glass-fronted gas fireplaces that are real heating appliances and that generated temperatures up to 500 degrees. And toddlers were getting third and second degree burns. They wander around like little drunks putting their hands on everything.
Right.
And they were getting their faces and hands horribly burned. And we wrote a number of stories about this, and the standard changed for, you know, protecting against that happening with a mesh screen. I can't say that 100% of that change was us. You never know for sure. Industries don't come along and go like, well, thank goodness you exposed us because now we've done something safer. But that was something I know we've saved some little kids and maybe some not so little ones from severe burns that not only are painful and disfiguring, but, you know, can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in healthcare costs. I mean, that was one story we did.
That's a great
one. We did. You asked about stories that other papers followed. You know, we did a story about the tobacco industry's global, you know, efforts to fight, you know, anti-smoking measures, you know, around the world. And we wrote about Australia and some countries in Africa and, you know, the Ukraine and these efforts by the big companies to undermine these controls on advertising and so on. And, you know, our story attracted a lot of praise. And then the New York Times came along and did the story, you know, a few months later. And clearly, I mean, I wasn't in on their conversations, but I'm sure.
You were there first.
Yes.
Yeah. That's cool. That's the key thing in every journalist's heart.
Yes.
So speaking of journalists, be honest here. Jack McAvoy skirts near the ethical edges of journalism in this story and the ones before it. And he has this innate ability to find reason and excuse for when he crosses lines. So tell the truth. Would you have fired Jack in real life?
Well, I hope it wouldn't have come to that. But maybe.
You would have tried to bring him back across the
Well, line. I mean, he had a conflict of interest. And, right. You know, there was, you know, let me just say, this is maybe off topic a little. In your books, maybe all of your books, but at least most of your books, there's always someone who is so wedded to the institutional mores or the bureaucratic rules that they're standing in the way of the truth seeker, whether it's the homicide detective or the reporter, whoever it is. And I had the honor, I guess, of being that person in this story because he, you know, just as in many of your other books, the protagonist is trying to figure out how to go over, under, around, or through this person that may be an obstacle. In real life, I mean, I don't know that we could have had someone who was at least for a time a subject of interest
right.
in a murder, going out and investigating the murder. That would have been pretty dicey. It was dicey. So I don't know.
The Myron in the book was very concerned.
Yes.
Well, the reason I asked that question is that, you know, is it possible that Jack may make a return appearance someday and work for Fair Warning in another book?
Yes, I think we would welcome him back because, for one thing, I mean, he left of his own accord, right? I mean, he leaves. So he wasn't fired and he was right. I mean, he got the story. It was such an important story. And it did a lot of good in the world, him getting the story, and it made Fair Warning look good. So if Jack drops his idea to become a podcaster for the rest of his career or for this phase of his career and wants to come back, we would hire him.
That's great to hear.
At the same princely salary that he was probably making.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you can do the podcast and make some money and work for Fair Warning as well.
Yes.
Well, thanks for being with me today, Myron, and more
My
so
pleasure.
Than, more so than today, though. Thanks for allowing me to tread into your world with my fictional conceits and ethical line-bending characters.
Well,
I appreciate it.
I mean, honestly, this is from the heart. I mean, we're honored that you did it. I mean, it was just bowled out of the blue, and we're so happy about it. So thanks.
All right. Thank you. And just end it with www.fairwarning.org.
Yeah, www.fairwarning.org.
Cool.